Good afternoon, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier. It's Monday, June 14th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. The Courier is forecasting a mostly sunny and more humid day today, a high of 88 degrees, and winds from the north between 7 and 14 miles per hour. Tonight will go down to 58 degrees under clear skies, winds from the south-southeast between 3 and 6 miles per hour. As we look around the region, mostly sunny and more humid today, clear tonight, plenty of sun tomorrow, Wednesday, mostly sunny, Thursday, mostly cloudy, with a thunderstorm in parts of the area. Friday will be sunny and will have patchy clouds. The next moon phase is first quarter, which will happen on June 17th. The sun rose this morning at 5:31 a.m., and it sets tonight at 8:49 p.m. Now, let's look at the lead stories on the front page of the Courier today. Afghan who aided U.S. forces faces deportation from Iowa. Adapt and adopt. And we'll begin with the story, GOP rushed to curb early votes in Iowa. Iowa voters embraced early voting. Then, Republicans rushed to restrict it. The story is filed by Tom Barton and Aaron Murphy of the Courier. As prospects for a federal voting rights bill flounder, Iowans who prefer to vote early will face more difficulties casting a ballot in the next election. Iowa voters will have less time and fewer options to vote early, in person, or by mail-in ballot, under sweeping changes to Iowa election laws passed this spring, the first in a Republican-backed nationwide push to pass so-called election integrity measures critics warn will disenfranchise voters. A raft of new restrictions in GOP-led states has sparked passionate debate across the country about voting rights, with President Joe Biden issuing a plea for legislation in Congress to protect the right to vote. Biden pledged that June will be a month of action on Capitol Hill as Congress considers the legislation and tasked Vice President Kamala Harris with leading the administration's efforts to defend voting rights. But months before, Iowa Republicans had moved swiftly in the legislative session to place new hurdles to casting votes before Election Day, limiting a voting method that has growing appeal for both Democrats and Republicans. Nearly 6 of 10 Iowa voters cast ballots before Election Day 2020. The proposal sped through the legislative process, being introduced and passed by the legislature in less than a week. Republicans say the goal is to prevent voter fraud and reassure voters that Iowa's elections are secure. Quote, "These reforms continue to make it easy to vote and hard to cheat," said Davenport Republican State Senator Roby Smith. The new law shortens the state's early voting period, shortens the period to request mail-in ballots, and bars election officials from proactively sending ballot request forms to voters, among other provisions. Voting rights experts, county election officials, and Democrats argue the changes will make it harder for minority, elderly, and disabled voters to cast ballots. Quote, "Taken as a whole, the bill targets and restricts virtually every aspect of the voting process, according to a lawsuit filed in Polk County District Court by the League of United Latin American Citizens of Iowa, or LULAC, which is represented by Washington-based voting rights lawyer Mark Elias in challenging the new restrictions. A hearing is scheduled for June 25th. The lawsuit claims the new law creates an undue burden on fundamental right to vote, citing numerous violations of voters' constitutional rights. It claims none of the provisions of the new law will make elections more secure or increase public confidence in the electoral process, but instead imposes, quote, "undue and unjustified burdens on a wide range of lawful voters, including some of the state's most vulnerable, underrepresented citizens," unquote. Quote, "This is because the bill is an exercise in voter suppression, one disguised as a solution for a problem that exists only in the fertile imaginations of its creators," the lawsuit states. Elias could not be reached for comment. Quote, "The biggest thing the new law will mean is confusion and disenfranchisement of legal Iowa voters, said Senate Minority Leader Zach Walls, a Democrat of Coralville. Quote, if this is about trying to restore faith in our elections, the only way to do that is to have bipartisan compromise. And there were no efforts for bipartisan compromise, unquote. Only Republicans voted in favor of the legislation, which Republican Governor Kim Reynolds signed into law on March 8th, just more than 2 weeks after its introduction. The new law made Iowa among the first states to create new hurdles in voting process in the wake of a 2020 election that saw record turnout. That has placed Iowa at the head of what has become a national wave of Republican-led states whose leaders have expressed concerns about the integrity of the 2020 elections, echoing persistent and false claims from former President Donald Trump of widespread fraud, costing him the 2020 election. Trump handily won Iowa, while Texas Democrats last month successfully blocked an effort to pass what would have been one of the most stringent new voting measures in the country. At least 14 states have passed new voting restrictions, including limiting early mail-in voting options, which Trump claimed cost him the election. A new Stanford University study, however, found record rates of vote by mail during pandemic did not help Democrats or lead to an increase in voting, as voters were already highly motivated to participate in the 2020 contest. At least 61 more bills with restrictive provisions were moving through 18 state legislatures as of May 14th, according to the Brennan Center for Justice Research Institute. All told, lawmakers have introduced at least 389 restrictive bills in 48 states this year. Suppression versus integrity. Reynolds has said the additional measures are necessary to reassure Iowans that Iowa's elections are secure, that despite Iowa having no history of fraud and none reported in the state in November's general election, which saw record turnout, Reynolds and other Republicans claim the law provides election officials with consistent parameters for election day, absentee voting, and database maintenance, as well as clear appeals process for local county auditors. Quote, it's our duty and responsibility to protect the integrity of every election, Reynolds said in a statement about signing the new law. Quote, all of these additional steps promote more transparency and accountability, giving Iowans even greater confidence to cast their ballot, unquote. Quote, the most important thing Republicans can do to restore faith in elections across America is to stop lying about the 2020 election, Wall said. When Republicans say voters don't trust the election, it's arsonists asking who started the fire, unquote. While Democrats claim the Iowa law amounts to voter suppression, Smith argues some provisions will increase voter participation. The legislation extends some deadlines to request absentee ballots, which Smith said would allow for more people to vote absentee. The law extends from 3 days to 10 days, the time period in which individuals who are hospitalized or admitted to an assisted living program or healthcare facility can request an absentee ballot, and it provides more time for individuals who fail to sign the affidavit on the envelope when returning their ballot. While the new law addresses some concerns raised by county auditors and advocates for vulnerable populations, Democrats and county election officials argue the changes attack the democratic voting process and will make it even harder for thousands of Iowans to have their absentee ballots counted. Quote, Iowa has a deserved reputation for fair, efficient, and smooth elections, Republican Sioux County Auditor Ryan Doctor, current president of the Iowa State Association of County Auditors, wrote in opposition to the changes. Quote, most of these provisions would threaten rather than help that reputation. Smith, who argues he has helped expand voting rights, citing a law allowing 17-year-olds to vote in primaries if they will turn 18 before the general election, called Democrats' assertion of voter suppression, quote, a tired, worn-out talking point, unquote. Quote, we went from 40 to 29 days 2 years ago to vote early, he said. And what did we hear? We heard it was going to suppress the vote. And what happened? We got record turnout in 2018 and 2020. Here's a look at what the new law does. Less time to vote on Election Day. The polls will close on Election Day at 8 p.m. instead of 9 p.m. Smith said the move to close the polls an hour earlier came from a 2019 request from the Iowa State Association of Counties and is meant to provide relief to the senior citizens who work the polls and make all elections uniform. For all elections, polls will close at 8 p.m., which was already the case with some nonpartisan elections. The Iowa State Association of Counties, in their 2019 request of lawmakers, argued the propensity for errors increases the later the day goes on, Election Day, and that the public, political parties, and media are calling for quicker results. At the same time, only Iowa and two other states had 9 p.m. poll closing times, less time to vote early. The number of days to vote early is reduced from 29 to 20. Until 2 years ago, Iowa's voting period had been 40 days. Smith argued the change brings Iowans' absentee and early vote windows closer to the national average. Doctor, the Republican Sioux County auditor, argues besides being less convenient for voters, the concentration of early voting over a shortened period requires the use of more county election staff and overtime, increasing workloads and tendency for errors. Stricter requirements for satellite voting. Local election officials also face stricter requirements to set up a satellite early voting location. The law requires a petition signed by at least 100 eligible voters to establish a location. Smith argued, quote, the people should decide where satellite voting locations are at, not the county auditors, unquote. Critics contend eliminating auditors' discretion to open convenient early voting locations based on their expertise will force voters to drive farther to vote in person at county auditors' offices, further hindering early voting and leading to longer lines and delays at the polls on Election Day. Less time to request and mail a ballot. Absentee ballot requests may begin 70 days before an election rather than the previous 120 days. And absentee ballots cannot be mailed to voters until 20 days before the election, down from 29 days, with limited exceptions. The new law also sets the last day for auditors to mail ballots at 15 days before the election. In practice, that allows only 5 business days for mailing ballots to every voter who requested one. It also gives staff less time to contact voters who may have omitted information on their absentee ballot request forms, critics argue. Additionally, early ballots must be received by the county auditor by Election Day, with limited exceptions for some late-arriving ballots cast by military and overseas voters, domestic violence survivors in the Safe at Home program, or those admitted to hospital or assisted living. Early ballots that arrive after Election Day will not be counted, no matter when they were mailed. Previously, absentee ballots returned by mail were considered timely if they were postmarked by the day before the election and delivered to the elections office by the Monday following the election. Democratic state lawmakers argue more than 6,500 absentee ballots cast in Iowa's 2020 general election arrived after Election Day because a postmark or barcode confirmed the voter mailed them on time. Had the new deadline been in place, several thousand Iowans would have had their votes tossed. No mass mailings of ballot request forms. Local officials can only mail out an absentee ballot request form if a voter requests one. The Iowa Supreme Court last year upheld a state directive from Republican Secretary of State Paul Pate that all absentee ballot request forms mailed to voters must be blank in order to ensure uniformity statewide. Auditors in 3 counties defied Pate's guidance and mailed forms to thousands of voters with their names, addresses, dates of birth, and voter PIN numbers already filled in. Voters just had to review, sign, and returned the forms, which the three auditors said were intended to make voting by mail as easy as possible during the COVID-19 pandemic. Critics argued that pre-filled forms opened the door to potential voter fraud should the wrong person receive a ballot application with another voter's personal information. In the end, the courts sided with Trump and the Republican Party officials, who sued to discard the absentee forms. Quote, certain counties were mailing out absentee ballot request forms, and we had other counties that were not, so voters were being treated differently, Smith said. Quote, if political parties want to send out ballot request forms, they can do that, unquote. Critics, including county election commissioners, argue the restriction serves no purpose other than to inhibit auditors' attempts to expand access to voting. Harder to return a ballot. Voters must return and submit their own early ballot, with limited exceptions. Only caretakers, immediate family, or household members and designated election officials can deliver an absentee ballot on behalf of someone else. Supporters say it prevents ballot harvesting, in which volunteers or campaigns collect filled out and sealed absentee ballots from voters' homes and drop them off at a polling place or election office. Democrats and county election officials argue the new restriction unnecessarily jeopardizes vulnerable Iowans, like the elderly, those lacking reliable transportation, or individuals with disabilities who live alone and have no relatives nearby, from returning ballots in a timely fashion. Previously, voters could enlist friends, neighbors, colleagues, and church members to return their absentee ballot. Now, doing so would make one guilty of a serious misdemeanor. Additionally, there can be only one drop box per county under video surveillance, regardless of its geographic size or population, for dropping off completed early ballots. Smith argues Iowa law previously did not allow the use of drop boxes except under emergency rules. However, the law did not expressly prohibit or limit the number of drop boxes, which some county auditors have said their offices have used for years without incident or objections, offering another method for voters to safely and securely return absentee ballots. Quote, limiting the number to one per county disallows auditors from having both a drive-up and a walk-up drop box on courthouse property, Doctor wrote, easier to be removed from voter rolls. A voter's registration status is changed to inactive if they miss just one election and have not reported a change of address, a process critics argue is accelerated and puts voters at greater risk of having their voter registration canceled. Previously, voters had to miss two consecutive general elections to be marked inactive. The Iowa Secretary of State's office mailed postcards to more than 294,000 Iowans in April who did not participate in the 2020 general election, informing them they had been marked inactive. That represents more than 13% of the state's 2.2 million registered voters. While being flagged as inactive does not immediately affect Iowans' ability to vote, it's the first step in a process that could result in their removal from voter rolls after four more years of inactivity. Quote, receiving this notice will not affect anyone's ability to vote in any election in 2021, 2022, 2023, or 2024, said Kevin Hall, spokesman for the Iowa Secretary of State's office. Quote, the voting experience for inactive voters is identical for active voters. After they do vote in any election in any of those years, their status returns to active. They can also sign and return the postcard, update their voter registration, or request an absentee ballot for any election through November 2024 to return to active status. Republicans argue the change ensures only those eligible to vote are registered and cleans up outdated, bloated voter rolls that they say invite fraud. Democrats argue the change is too aggressive, could lead to purges of some eligible voters. Indeed, roughly 417-year-olds who legally registered to vote but could not cast ballots in the 2020 election because of their age, were among the 294,000 registered Iowa voters recently marked as inactive. In this next story, filed by Aaron Murphy, former interpreter living in Iowa, who helped U.S. military, faces deadly deportation. And it begins with a photograph with the caption, Zalmay Nizy worked as an interpreter for U.S. military forces in Afghanistan. Now the U.S. government plans to deport him from Iowa to Afghanistan for almost certain death. And we see a desert scene with a U.S. Army soldier standing next to and with his arm around Zalmay Nizy. Des Moines. The terrorists rode on motorcycles to the home in Afghanistan. They wore masks and carried guns. They came upon a little boy, grabbed him by the neck, and demanded he bring them bread. If he didn't, they would harm him and his family, they said. The boy was 9 years old. He had never seen a gun before. He was scared, and he did as they asked. That interaction decades later could prove to be a death sentence for Zalmay Nizy, an Iowa Falls man, and the little boy in that story. A decade after the day he brought a piece of bread, quote, a piece no bigger than a cell phone, to those terrorists, Zalmay Nizy, who had learned English as a child, worked as an interpreter for U.S. military forces in Afghanistan. For 3 years, from 2007 to 2009, he put his life in danger, both at work, he was wounded in multiple bombings, and at home, where Taliban forces threatened him and his family. The Taliban in 2008 made good on its threats, killing Nizy's uncle, he said. A few years later, Nizy's employer sent him to a work conference in Washington, D.C. Nizy made plans to not only attend the conference, but while in the U.S., applied for political asylum under a program created for former interpreters who aided the U.S. military. Shortly after arriving in America, it became clear the Taliban knew of Nizy's travels, and the threats resumed. Nizy's parents warned him not to return home. They feared if he did, the Taliban would kill him. Nizy reached out to a family member already in the States. His cousin, Farad Ahmad, lived in Iowa Falls. Ahmad also had worked as an interpreter and immigrated to the U.S. through the same program to which Nizy hoped to apply. Nizy moved in with his cousin in 2015 and has lived in Iowa Falls ever since. He applied for political asylum through the Special Immigrant Visa Program, although he did not hear about his case for years. Meantime, he made a life for himself in Iowa Falls. He worked odd jobs, landscaping, construction, and others, to make money. While there were setbacks along the way, he continued to work, sometimes 12-hour days for 7 days a week, he said. Now, Nizy runs his own contracting company, Z Handyman Services, named after the nickname Z, by which he has become known around Iowa Falls. He bought a home, which he has renovated. But just as life was getting comfortable for Nizy, he was dealt a crushing blow. In May, his application for asylum was denied by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. The reason? That interaction Nizy has as a 9-year-old boy with Taliban terrorists. Quote, I'm very disappointed, to be honest with you, Nizy said this week during a phone call interview from his home in Iowa Falls. Quote, I thought I will be treated a little better by the government. I've been very, very disgusted by what I got and what I have went through over the last 6 years of my life. Nizy is scheduled for a hearing before an immigration judge June 28th in Omaha. The Iowa Falls community has rallied around Nizy, hoping to find a way for him to stay in the U.S., because if he is forced to return to Afghanistan, quote, that is a death sentence, Nizy said. Keith Herting, a Des Moines attorney who has been working with Nizy, said what constitutes support of terrorism in recent years has expanded to become more skewed. He points to a 2018 case in which a woman was denied asylum because, after being captured and seeing her husband murdered by the guerrillas in El Salvador, she was forced to cook and clean for the guerrillas. Providing those services, even under threat of death, was considered by the immigration court to be support of terrorists. Herding is concerned Niazi will suffer the same fate. Quote, I don't like putting odds on outcomes for my clients, but the case law is not positive for Zalmi, Hurtig wrote in an email. Quote, certainly, we still have hope that we can get people interested enough in his story that there may be positive change. But without some reform in the law, he's facing a very steep uphill climb. I am sure the court will be sympathetic to his story, but sympathy doesn't change the law, and the law in this area is fundamentally rotten, unquote. Niazi made clear his frustration is with the U.S. government and its asylum laws, not with the people he has met here. He expressed a deep love of and gratitude for the Iowa Falls community. Quote, Iowa's been very great to me, and that's why I've stayed here. I have close family in other states, but I love Iowa Falls. I've been treated good, Niazi said. I'm overwhelmed with the support of the whole state, especially Iowa Falls, unquote. Niazi's story has been told before. It has been documented by his hometown paper, the Iowa Falls Times-Citizen, and in 2017 gained national attention after Niazi spoke at a town hall hosted by Iowa's longtime Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley. Niazi is trying to remain optimistic. Like the community that has embraced him, he is exhausting all options, hoping to find a way to remain in the U.S. He has to, because the alternative is dire. Quote, I guess I have to fight it, Niazi said. That's the only way that I can survive, unquote. You are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Monday, June 14th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to the sports page. In news about the NASCAR Cup Series, Larson cashes another $1 million check, filed by Stephen Hawkins of the Associated Press. And the story opens with Kyle Larson celebrating his victory. He's pointing two pistols up in the air, and we can see confetti and sponsors' names on a banner behind him. And his Busch trophy is also prominent in front of Kyle. Fort Worth, Texas. Kyle Larson was back in the NASCAR All-Star Race and got another $1 million by winning it again. Larson held off a hard-charging Brad Keselowski during the final 10-lap shootout at Texas on Sunday night after a slippery three-wide pass to get back in front and push Hendrick Motorsports to its second consecutive win and 10th overall in the annual non-points race with a seven-figure prize. Defending All-Star winner and reigning Cup champion Chase Elliott, who started the sixth and final segment out front, didn't stay there long. Larson pushed his teammate, then got in front on the outside through the fourth turn. They were three wide while Keselowski pulled ahead briefly at the line before Larson finally got ahead to stay for the last eight laps. Quote, that last restart worked out exactly how I needed it to. I wanted Chase not to get a good run down the back, Larson said. Quote, thankfully, I think Keselowski got to his inside, and I just shoved him down the back, and he probably thought I was going to just follow him, and I was like, there's got to be enough grip where we'd be running for one corner, he said. It was a little slick up there, but I was able to get it and hold him off from there. I can't believe it. There were no points on the line, but Larson went to victory lane for the third weekend in a row and the fourth time overall this season. Keselowski said running second to Hendrick cars these days is somewhat of an accomplishment. Quote, they're just stupid fast, and I had him off turn four, but they just have so much speed, Keselowski said. He just motored right on back by me, like, damn. Larson was at Chip Ganassi Racing when he won the 2019 All-Star Race, but missed last year's big event at Bristol while serving a six-month suspension after using a racial slur during the live stream while in a virtual race during the pandemic. That nearly cost him his career, but Hendrick gave him an opportunity this season to get back into the Cup Series. Second in points with 10 races to go before the playoffs, Larson is now only the 8th driver to be a 2-time All-Star race winner. Elliott finished 3rd, with Joey Logano 4th, ahead of Ryan Blaney and Alex Bowman. William Byron, Eric Almirola, Kyle Busch, and Kurt Busch rounded out the top 10 in the 21-car field. Hendrick drivers Elliott, Byron, and Larson started the final segment 1-2-3. Elliott had moved from 3rd to 1st during the 30-lap 5th segment that included a required 4-tire stop and $100,000 prize for his crew that had the fastest stop. Byron won the 4th segment and had the lowest cumulative finish through the first 4 15-lap segments. Larson, who won the last 2 Cup races, was on the pole by a random draw and was still in front at the end of the first segment. After a random inversion of the top 12 finishers in that first stage, Blaney was moved from 12th to 1st to start the next 15 laps. Blaney stayed in front, even holding on after wriggling because of contact from behind by Ross Chastain, one of 3 drivers who advanced to the main event from the earlier open qualifying race. After a full field inversion going to the 3rd stage, Eric Almirola, who also got in through the qualifying race, went from last to 1st, but it was Bowman, after getting pushed up from 17th to 5th in the lead after that 15 laps. On a hot night deep in the heart of Texas, drivers emerged through the saloon doors on a huge facade during pre-race introductions while their cars were rolled through a corral gate. Drivers did their warm-up laps while Sammy Hagar performed I Can't Drive 55 from the stands, ending right at the green flag. It was 97 degrees with the sun still shining when the race started, with a heat index of 106 Fahrenheit. The track temperature had been in the mid-140s during the earlier open qualifying race, though there were some areas of shade by the time the main event started. Texas is the 3rd different track in 3 years for the All-Star race. It was moved last summer from Charlotte, which hosted 34 of the first 35 All-Star races because of COVID-19 restrictions in North Carolina. The All-Star race at Texas served as a send-off and full-circle finish for old-school NASCAR promoter Eddie Gossage, the Texas Motor Speedway president, working his last day for Speedway Motorsports. Gossage, now 62, had considered stepping down for at least 2 years. He was chosen by Speedway Motorsports founder Bruton Smith to oversee the 1,500-acre complex since its groundbreaking in 1995, 2 years before the first Cup race at the track that included a big crash in the first turn of the first lap. He was a young public relations director at Charlotte Motor Speedway in 1992 when, during a news conference to promote NASCAR's first nighttime All-Star race, one of his stunts literally set Smith's hair on fire. When Smith threw the giant light switch rigged by Gossage to highlight the Charlotte Speedway's new lighting system, sparks flew. 3 days after he thought he was headed for the unemployment line, Gossage is going out on his own terms. He planned to spend Monday at the pool with his 3 grandchildren. And now in men's professional soccer, doctors said Erickson was gone before being resuscitated. Story is filed by Matthias Karen of the Associated Press and begins with a photograph of a team being addressed by its coach. And the caption says, Denmark's manager Kasper Julmund instructs his players during the halftime of the Euro 2020 Soccer Championship Group B match between Denmark and Finland on Saturday at Parken Stadium in Copenhagen, Denmark. Copenhagen. Denmark's team doctor said Sunday that Christian Eriksen's heart stopped and that he was gone before being resuscitated with a defibrillator at the European Championship. Eriksen collapsed during Denmark's opening Euro 2020 group game against Finland on Saturday and was given lengthy medical treatment before regaining consciousness. Quote, he was gone, and we did cardiac resuscitation, and it was cardiac arrest, said team doctor Morten Bosen, who led the work in giving Erickson treatment on the field. How close were we? I don't know. We got him back after one defib. That's quite fast. Erickson was in stable condition at a Copenhagen hospital and had spoken to teammates via video link on Sunday, team officials said. Bosen said it was still unclear what caused the midfielder's collapse. Quote, I'm not a cardiologist, so the details about why it happened and further, I will leave to the experts, he said. He also said the 29-year-old Erickson may not have survived had the game not been played at a major soccer tournament with top-class medical equipment on hand. That was completely decisive, I think, Bosen said. The time from when it happened to when he receives help is a critical factor, and that time was short. It was decisive. Denmark coach Kasper Hjalmand said when he spoke to Erickson, the Inter Milan midfielder was more concerned about his teammates' well-being than his own. Quote, he said, I don't remember much, but I'm more concerned about you guys. How are you doing? Hjalmand said. That's typical Christian. It was good to see him smile, unquote. The Danish players and team staff were being given crisis management assistance as they processed the incident. Erickson fell face forward to the ground late in the first half, and his teammates formed a protective circle around him while the medics gave him treatment. The game was suspended for about 90 minutes before resuming. Finland won 1-0 after scoring in the second half. Denmark canceled a planned training session on Sunday, but Hjalmand said they would try to go back to their normal routines on Monday. He insisted the players are determined to finish the tournament, with Denmark playing Belgium next in Group B on Thursday. Quote, Erickson would like us to play, Hjalmand said. We are trying to get back to some normality tomorrow. It is completely in line with what the psychologists are saying and the way I want to try to lead this group forward. The decision to restart the game on Saturday has been heavily criticized by many in Denmark, including former players Peter Schmeichel and Michael Laudrup. UEFA gave Denmark the option to resume the game Sunday at noon, but the players opted to finish it Saturday evening instead. A later date was not possible because Finland plays its second group game on Wednesday in St. Petersburg, Russia. Hjalmand said he remained proud of his players for finishing the game, but that he now has had second thoughts about not insisting it should have been called off. Quote, in hindsight, I wonder if I could have done something differently, Hjalmand said. Quote, because when I look back, I honestly do not think we should have been back on the field. I am so proud that the players were able to mobilize and give it a try. It was a huge effort, but I have a guilty conscience that we were back out there, unquote. Now in Northwoods League baseball, Bucks rally past Duluth for Sunday victory. Waterloo. Daniel Israri homered, and Waterloo Bucks used a 3-run seventh to beat the Duluth Huskies 5-2 on Sunday afternoon in Northwoods League action at Riverfront Stadium. Jordan Nelson pitched 5 innings of 2-hit ball, walking none and striking out 3 to earn the win for Waterloo. The Bucks scored 3 unearned runs in the 7th to break up a 2-2 tie. Garrett McGowan drove in his 17th run of the season, and Max Young Goldberg drove in another run for Waterloo. Chris Tsang was 2-for-3 with a run scored. Waterloo improved to 10-4 overall and have a 3-game lead over La Crosse in the Great Plains East Division. The Bucks play at St. Cloud Monday at 7:05 p.m. Saturday, McGowan hit for the cycle, but the Bucks watched as the Huskies rallied from a 10-3 deficit to win 14-12 in 10 innings on Saturday. Waterloo led 10-3 after 6 innings, but the Huskies scored 8 runs over the next 3 innings to force extra and then tacked on 3 in the top of the 10th to pull out the win. McGowan hit a 2-run home run to left in the first, singled in the second, singled again in the third, tripled in the 6th, and finished off the cycle with a double to left in the seventh. McGowan finished 5 for 6 while scoring twice and driving in 5 runs. It's the first cycle by a Bucks player since 1997. Paul Stephenson scored 3 times while Young Goldberg was 2 for 4 with 3 RBIs, additionally for the Bucks, who improved to a 10-3 for the win. Friday, Waterloo closed out a road trip with 10-3 win over Eau Claire. Paul Stephenson went 3 for 5 with 2 runs and 2 RBIs. Garrett McGowan, Max Young Goldberg, Danielle Isari, and Emilio Gonzalez all had 2 hits. Gabe Baldovino drove in a pair of runs and scored twice. Now let's continue reading more local news. This story from the front page. Adapt and adopt. Cedar Bend's shelters' pandemic protocols are less stressful for pets. This story is filed by Melody Parker of the Courier, Waterloo. For many animals, the shelter is a stressful place. Nearly every day, dozens of people pass by rows of kennels in search of their perfect match. Dogs bark, jump, and are wildly happy, or fearful, anxious, and agitated. Some cats may be social, curious, and open to a cuddle, while others are scaredy cats and hide from strangers and noise. It quickly becomes sensory overload, which means people may overlook a good dog or cat in need of a best friend. When COVID took away that steady foot traffic, shelter executive directors like Christy Gardner at Cedar Bend Humane Society learned a valuable lesson. Now the shelter has a new way of handling adoptions that benefits both pets who need forever homes and the kind hearts who want to give them a place to belong. Quote, "We are here, first and foremost, for the animals. When anyone could come through the doors, it was nothing for us to have between 70 and 120 people, which is a good thing, but some dogs just didn't show well. People would look at the dog and say, 'I'll pass,' and not take the time to let us get the dog out for them to meet," Gardner explained. The shelter closed to the public in April 2020 because of the COVID pandemic and reopened several months later with limited access. Adoptions were handled by appointment only, a policy that is being kept in place post-COVID, but with a few tweaks. A potential adopter must complete an online adoption application. If approved, an adoption counselor arranges an appointment for a shelter visit to interact with the animals. Meetings generally last 1 hour. In addition, anyone who has filled out an application and received approval can visit the shelter without an appointment. Applications are kept on file for 90 days. Quote, "We began noticing that when we didn't have a lot of people walking through the kennels, the dogs were calmer and less stressed. You don't hear all of the barking when you come into the building. It's been better for all of the animals and for the adopters, who get to spend more one-on-one time with them," unquote. Dogs who were overlooked because of their wild child antics inside their kennels, Gardner explained, have been better behaved and easier to home. Cats don't hide as much, and their environment is less stressful. The shelter took in about 3,000 animals between July 2020 and April 2021, including dogs, cats, guinea pigs, hamsters, and other, quote, "pocket pets," domestic rabbits, and occasionally wildlife. No animals were euthanized for space, Gardner said. Adoption did not decrease during the pandemic. The shelter placed nearly 2,000 companion pets in 2020, along with 210 barn and TNR cats. Injured and sick animals received medical treatment, and the trap-neuter return program for feral cats continued. Quote, "Our returns have decreased too, because adopters were able to spend more time with the animals. Our mission is to best serve the animal and serve the community, and make sure an adopter has the opportunity to find the pet that fits their family," Gardner said. Every animal available is now posted at a cedarbendhumane.org and Pet Finder websites, which has made a huge difference in adoptions, she explained. Quote, "That's where people look first and read the descriptions about the dogs or cats they're interested in meeting. We will work hard to keep that a constant. She praised the CBHS staff for their dedication and resilience throughout the pandemic. Quote, the animals' needs remained the same, whatever was happening with COVID. The staff did an excellent job, which is the reason we got through this as well as we did. Everyone worked together. Community support, too, has been unwavering and greatly appreciated, the executive director said. She's also excited that volunteers are beginning to return after more than a year-long absence. Orientation dates for the new volunteers have not been set. Typically, 200 to 300 volunteers participate at some level, including cleaning kennels, caring for animals, socializing cats, walking dogs, etc. Now through August, CBHS hours on Thursday and Friday will be from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. to encourage more adoptions. Regular hours are 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., Tuesday, Wednesday, Saturday, and Sunday. CBHS is closed on Monday. Next, Union High graduate receives Farm Bureau Award. Court Holub honored with Young Farmer Leadership December 7th and 8th. Story filed by Kristen Guess. Waterloo. A young area farmer has been recognized for efforts to encourage and promote other young farmers. Court Holub, 27, of Buckingham, was one of three recipients of Iowa Farm Bureau Federation's Young Farmer Leadership Award for his involvement in Farm Bureau activities, agricultural advocacy efforts, and service to his community. Quote, I really take pride in taking care of my land, and my goal is to leave this place better than I found it, he said. Holub, a graduate of Union High School in LaPorte City and former FFA member, is part of a five-generation family. He lives on a 2,000-acre fourth-generation farm near Buckingham, where he farms with his father, Craig, wife, Krista, and brother, Cade. He's also a seed salesman and a corn, soybean, and cow-calf farmer with passion for conservation. Holub's leadership also transcends his farm into local community, where he assisted with recovery efforts after the 2020 derecho and helped coordinate a $5,000 grant to the local fire department for rescue tools. He has served on his County Farm Bureau Board as voting delegate, is a 2018 Ag Leaders Institute graduate, and serves on the IFBF Young Farmer Advisory Committee. He has been a leader in legislative and policy issues, attending many town halls and hosted Governor Kim Reynolds on his family farm to sign a young farmer assistance bill. Holub is a member of the local Cattlemen's Association, Iowa Soybean Association, Buckingham Cooperative, and Tama Benton Cooperative. Holub and his brother Cade, 30, took on several side jobs about 3 years ago as commodity prices dropped. Between selling seeds, baling hay, trucking grain, custom planting, and custom spraying, we'll do whatever it takes to keep the farm going, Holub said. Holub said his passion for farming begins with his ancestors who arrived in the United States from Czechoslovakia before the Civil War. They settled in Wisconsin where they farmed, and later Holub's great-grandfather began farming near Traer in the 1930s before moving to Buckingham. Holub's grandfather, Norman, was always proud of his name and ancestry, he said. Quote, Grandpa was the mastermind behind getting the farm going, he said. In 2002, Norman and a hired farmhand died in a tractor accident, leaving a large void in the family farm operation. Holub's father, Craig, stepped in when Holub was in second grade. Quote, I would like to say that I am carrying on his tradition of taking care of the land and the farm and carrying on the tradition of a family farm and making an impact in the community, Holub said. Holub also learned from his grandmother, Wilma, who performed management duties for the farm and was charged with keeping the farm alive, along with her passion for teaching at the preschool in Dysart. She was probably the strongest woman I have ever met and known, Holub said. In 2015, Wilma had a stroke and began to struggle with the farm. Holub had just received his agricultural business management degree from Hawkeye Community College in Waterloo and moved in with his grandmother so she could stay on the farm. He also learned the ropes of farm management, helping her make decisions on purchasing inputs and selling crops. Wilma died in November from COVID-19 at the age of 87 after her passing. Cord and his father and brother took on all responsibilities. "We're carrying on the family farm just like Grandma and Grandpa wanted," he said. Holub is dedicated to encouraging other young farmers to keep their family farms in business too. But the struggle is great. "The price of land has skyrocketed in the past 10 years, he said, as well as the cost of seed, fertilizer, and chemicals. Since the pandemic, Holub has seen a shortage of equipment parts that has led to increased prices for parts and repairs. Quote, "It's been quite a hammer on farmers the past few years," he said. The Holub family farm was hit by a derecho in 2011 and again in 2020, and is now seeing one of the worst droughts in maybe 128 years, Holub said. The Young Farmer Leadership Award for farmers under the age of 35 honors past IFBF President Bob Jocelyn, who was well known for his support of young farmers. This year's recipients will be honored during the IFBF annual meeting December 7th through 8th in Des Moines. Along with the Farm Bureau honor, Holub received a $2,000 grant to designate to a nonprofit of his choice. He will donate the money to Little Knights Learning Center in Dysart in honor of his grandmother. Quote, "I knew I was up against some very good competition. We don't get paid to do this type of stuff. We just like interacting with the community and telling our story," he said. He'll also receive an expense-paid trip to the 2022 AFBF Annual Convention, or Young Farmers and Ranchers Conference, an expense-paid trip to the 2022 IFBF Young Farmer Conference, a Choice Hotel Certificate for 50,000 points of $500 value, and $1,500 cash from GrowMark. Now a story filed by the Associated Press. COVID cases wane. Vaccine-lagging areas are still at risk. Jackson, Mississippi. New COVID-19 cases are declining across most of the country, even in some states with vaccine-hesitant populations. But almost all states bucking that trend have lower-than-average vaccination rates, and experts warn that relief from the pandemic could be fleeting in regions where few people get inoculated. Case totals nationally have declined in a week from a 7-day average of nearly 21,000 on May 29th to 14,315 on Saturday, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. For weeks, states and cities have been dropping virus restrictions and mask mandates, even indoors. Experts said some states are seeing increased immunity because there were high rates of natural spread of the disease, which has so far killed nearly 600,000 Americans. Quote, "We certainly are getting some population benefit from our previous cases, but we've paid for it," said Mississippi State Health Officer Dr. Thomas Dobbs. Quote, "We paid for it with deaths. More than 7,300 Mississippians have died in the pandemic, and the state has the sixth highest per capita death rate." Dobbs estimated that about 60% of the state's residents have some underlying immunity. "So we're now sort of seeing that effect, most likely, because we have a combination of natural and vaccine-induced immunity," Dobbs said. Just eight states, Alabama, Arkansas, Hawaii, Missouri, Nevada, Texas, Utah, and Wyoming, have seen their 7-day rolling average for infection rates rise from 2 weeks earlier, according to data compiled by Johns Hopkins University. All of them, except Hawaii, have recorded vaccination rates that are lower than the U.S. average of 43% fully vaccinated, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The 10 states with the fewest new cases per capita over the time frame all have fully vaccinated rates above the national average. Medical experts said a host of factors is playing into the drop in case counts across the country, including vaccines, natural immunity from exposure to the virus, warmer weather, and people spending less time indoors. Melody Parker filed this story. Garden gates open for Saturday tour to benefit Grout Historic Homes. The tall, gnarled tree trunk standing in the corner of Tracy Grandy and Patrick Ashwood's backyard garden is draped in trumpet vine and wrapped in orange honeysuckle in full bloom. Most homeowners would have taken down what remains of the old elm tree years ago, but the couple kept it because we got married beneath it, said Ashworth. For 20 years, they have worked to create a pesticide-free, wildlife-welcoming environment filled with multiple gardens. Each year, a little more lawn is transformed into garden space, said Grandy. Their garden is one of seven gardens that will be open to the public Saturday for the 2021 Garden Tours presented by Friends of the Grout Historic Homes. The tour is from 1 to 5 p.m., and participants can view the gardens in any order. Tickets are $10 and available on the Grout Museum's website. Presenting sponsors are Cook Construction and Matthias Landscaping. Proceeds will support maintenance and upkeep of the 1861 Italianate Rensselaer Russell House Museum and the Snowden House, an Italianate Victorian home built in 1881. Both houses are listed on the National Registration of Historic Places. Whimsical sculptures and metal art punctuate the Mary and Jeff Schwecke Garden, which also features a koi pond, two relaxing settings for lounging and entertaining, and numerous pots and planters of annuals intermingling with perennials. The 40-acre Cedar Valley Arboretum and Botanic Garden features a stout daylily collection, giant topiary structures using thousands of bedding plants, water features, and a children's garden. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Monday, June 14th. I'm your reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time, and you may wish to stay tuned to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, which follows shortly. Thanks for listening, and have a great week.